So, the first week of December and the countdown to Christmas. I warned you it was coming last week, and here we are. The first year I came to All Saints, I distinctly remember hearing the word Advent and spending a good couple of weeks trying to figure out what that was. To me, all Advent really was the chocolate calendars you get given, and my mum would give one to me and one to my sister every year. And my sister, being the angel that she was, would diligently open each of the doors on the correct dates and pull out one chocolate Santa at a time. Her nightmare brother, on the other hand, I probably got about 3 days in before I got bored, opened all the doors, ate all the chocolate, and then I would go through and try and reseal each of the doors in the hope that Mum wouldn't notice. She always noticed. But hope is, in fact, our theme for today. And to help us explore the idea of hope, we're returning to John's Gospel. And I don't know if anyone has noticed, but we've kind of become John's unofficial book club over the last few weeks. Last month, we worked out of John 14. And over the last 2 weeks, we've had David speak to us about Revelation, which church tradition holds to be the same John who wrote the Gospel of John. And it's no coincidence that over those 3 weeks, our thematic scope has been really wide. We've gone from questions of humanity and existential dread to the pretty confronting imagery of Revelation. And I think it's really fitting that we circle back and we see what it is that John has to say about hope. Amongst all these issues, all these big questions and confronting themes, at the most basic level, what is the cause for our Christian hope? Now, last week, David showed us that in his overview of Revelation, that the Bible actually has a happy ending. A new heaven and a new earth, living together with God in peace. So fundamentally, Revelation is a book all about hope. And yet, for most of us, if we were really in need of a lift, we probably wouldn't turn to the book of Revelation. And I think the trouble we have is that as modern Christians, at least modern Christians, the picture we see in Revelation, a new earth with God and humanity living together, it's an abstraction. It's almost fictional. It's so far removed from the reality we have here on this earth that I think we sometimes struggle to kind of draw hope out of that promise. But for the early church, who frequently faced persecution, both in their local communities and on a state level, this was really the promise of a future without pain, without fear, and of peace. That was really the future that they longed for. Imagery of death and devastation that we see in Revelations, that's kind of old news for them. They were living in it. But for us, living thousands of years removed in little old New Zealand, I think our perception of hope is actually a little bit different. For us, hope isn't so much a response to persecution, as much as it might feel like that. It's more of a search for connection, I think, a search for something personal. So with that in mind, I'd like to explore John 11 this morning under three headings. Jesus as fully God, Jesus as fully human, and Jesus the hope of humanity. Jesus as God, human, and hope. So, our first chapter opens by telling us of a man named Lazarus, who has become very sick. Now, Lazarus was the brother of Martha and Mary, who we actually read about in Luke's Gospel. And that's the story where Martha famously, who I'm assuming to be the older sister, sort of has a dig at her younger sister for not helping her out with the dinner preparations and having the gall to sit there and listen to Jesus instead. And we can deduce that this family was really close to Jesus, not least of all because the two sisters sent word to Jesus saying, "The one whom you love is ill." So upon hearing that his beloved friend is sick, what is it that Jesus does? Nothing. He does nothing. For 2 days, he stays where he is. And for once, I think this is a course of action that the disciples might have actually liked. You see, Lazarus lives in Bethany, a village, as we heard, just barely 3 miles out of Jerusalem. And if you had read John's previous chapter leading up to this one, you'll see that Jesus' last visit to the Temple of Jerusalem didn't go so well. So if Jesus was to cross the Jordan and return to that city, the disciples knew that he would almost certainly be killed. However, for Martha and Mary, the sisters of Lazarus, this course of action was unthinkable. Their brother, his friend, was on death's door, and Jesus was going to do nothing. So the 2 days go by before Jesus announces that he is returning to Judea. Naturally, his disciples protest, "Rabbi, the Jews were just seeking to stone you, and you were going there again?" "Lazarus has died," Jesus responds finally, "so let us go to him." Which prompts Thomas, being the little ray of sunshine that he is, to declare, "Let us go also, so that we may die with him." He was brave, Thomas. And off they go to Bethany. And by the time they arrive, they find that indeed Lazarus has passed away and has been laid in his tomb 4 days prior. Now, 4 days is significant. In ancient Jewish culture, there existed sort of this extra-biblical belief, which is to say a belief that you're not going to find in Scripture, that in death, one's soul or spirit would linger for 3 to 7 days. In that time, the dead person's spirit would wander between his body and his former home, places of interest. And the logic follows that on the 3rd day, the spirit would return to its body one last time and hope that he or she could be restored. By the 4th day, the spirit would abandon its body permanently and either linger in the land of the living, if the body had not been buried, or depart to the realm of the dead. As such, the bulk of mourning in ancient Jewish culture wouldn't take place until the 3rd day. The last chance for resurrection. So arriving finally at the village of Bethany, we see Martha rush out to meet Jesus. "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you." "Your brother will rise again," Jesus answers. "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." And Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he dies, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this?" "Yes, Lord. I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who is coming into the world." Now, first time reading that, you might well ask, what just happened? Martha comes running out to Jesus, you know, grieving, angry, confused, wanting an explanation, and her and Jesus have a theological discussion about it. They sort of stand there trading blows. "I know God will give you whatever you ask. Yes, your brother will rise again. Yeah, I know he'll rise again on the final day. I am the resurrection." It's so peculiar. Jesus almost tells her off. In the midst of her pain, Jesus issues this ultimatum. Why? I think many people, then as now, mistake Jesus for a hero, kind of Heracles or Perseus, Samson or David. For us modern folk, perhaps not such a fan of all that killing, I think we picture Jesus something like a wizard, like Gandalf. Wise, loving, powerful, but limited. Someone special, someone able to achieve great things and perform miracles, but who is ultimately still subject to the world and its forces, like an actor upon a stage corralled between curtains and wings. And I think it's that misconception that is informing Martha's thinking. "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died, but now it is the 4th day, and you are too late." And Jesus responds, "Your perception of me is too small." Jesus is no classical hero nor an actor upon a stage. He is God, Emmanuel, literally God with us. There is no force or rule that restricts his authority. He is the master of creation, God in human form. It's kind of like the I ams we had from last month. Jesus is not bringing truth and life. He is truth and life. And in the same sense, Jesus is not just capable of resurrection. He is the resurrection because he is life itself. Jesus, fully God. And that's point one. From verses 28, we see that Martha returns to the village to tell her sister Mary that Jesus is asking for her. So Mary gets up and runs to Jesus and falls at his feet. "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." And when Jesus saw her weeping and the Jews who had come with her also, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. And he said, "Where have you laid him?" They said to him, "Lord, come and see." And Jesus wept. So the Jews said, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, "Could he who opened the eyes of the blind man also have kept this man from dying?" There is some debate as to whether the Greek term behind the phrase "deeply moved," or in Greek, embrimaomi, as far as I can pronounce it, means to be suddenly disarmed by grief, as we would see in this translation, or actually to clench your fists and bellow with anger. The word used in the literal sense is actually found in early Greek plays, used to describe war horses rearing upwards and snorting with anger before charging into battle. However, you know, with all words, there's a contextual element, and Bible scholars were quick to point out that there's a reason we have this more common translation. So we don't really know what John is meaning here. What we do know is that John is trying to convey deep emotional turmoil. Jesus is not modestly moved to tears. He's not dabbing at his eyes with a handkerchief. Jesus is experiencing overwhelming anguish. But why? Of all people at the tomb that day, Jesus is the only one who knows everything's going to be okay. He's come specifically to raise Lazarus. Surely he could, you know, coolly make his way up to the cave entrance, raise Lazarus, put on his sunglasses, and walk into the sunset. And yet, he weeps. Why? Because it's his creation, his world, and there's death. Death brought on by our rebellion. Sin, war, misery, illness, death. And he feels it. In the deepest parts of himself, he feels it. Fully God, yet fully human. For all his majesty and incomprehensible otherness, the Son of God is weeping outside a dusty village. He weeps because his friend has died, and he weeps because Jesus knows there's only one way to bring him back. From verse 38, "Then Jesus, deeply moved again, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone lay against it. Jesus said, 'Take away the stone.' Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, 'Lord, by this time there will be an odor, for he has been dead 4 days.' Jesus said to her, 'Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?' So they took away the stone. And Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, 'Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I know that you always hear me, but I say this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me.' When he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, 'Lazarus, come out.' And the man who had died came out, his hands and feet bound with linen strips and his face wrapped in a cloth. Jesus said to them, 'Unbind him and let him go.'" Church tradition holds that the time between Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead and facing his own execution was a little more than 2 weeks. Raising someone from the dead, mere miles from Jerusalem, this was a direct challenge to the authority of the Pharisees. This was the miracle that forced their hand. And Jesus knew this. But he did it anyway. In a very real sense, the two men switched places that day. Lazarus walked out of the tomb, and Jesus walked in. Jesus, the master of creation, traded his life for his friend. Fully God and fully human. As we were reading, you might have noticed that in his interaction with the two sisters, Martha and Mary, Jesus is met by the same challenge. Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. Word for word, the sisters address Jesus in exactly the same way, yet Jesus gives two radically different answers. In the case of Martha, Jesus meets her head on. I am the resurrection. I am the life. Put your faith in me. And you compare that to Mary. Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. And Jesus bursts into tears and cries out in anguish. Two women, same question, two completely different responses. Why? Because she's Martha and she's Mary. One sister wants answers, while the other just wants an arm around her. And Jesus graciously provides both. As the late Dr. Keller put it in a sermon at Oxford, Martha required the ministry of truth, but Mary required the ministry of tears. Because Jesus is fully God, he can address Martha as the author of creation, the Messiah, the Son of God, who has come into the world to save her brother from death. And because Jesus is fully human, he can meet Mary crying at his feet and be overwhelmed by grief. He can weep with her. Personally, I can't really speak to the pain of losing a close loved one. I'm perhaps not old enough for that yet. However, as a young man about 11 years old, I did experience a different kind of loss. I have a very clear recollection of the day my father moved out, right down to the bag he packed. It was like a green bag with brown stitching. If you've seen Treasure Planet, the animated movie, and the flashback scene where Jim's dad leaves, that's very much how it felt, kind of chasing his dad down the driveway as he left. And following that, there were two comforts for me. The first, oddly enough, was actually like Martha. It was theological. My parents are flawed people, just like all of us, but God isn't. He's the ultimate parent and the ultimate dad. The second comfort, however, is one that I'm still working through, and the height of that process was living with Andrew and Elaine. In a very real way, that experience restored that aspect of family which I had lost, especially in the department, the vacuum that my father left. And that's Christ's provision. That's his healing. And it's the same provision and healing we see in John. Jesus fully God, Jesus fully human, both aspects realized perfectly in the character of Jesus. Jesus, the hope of humanity. That's point three. And just as we finish, I want to read what I can only describe as an academic poem from the same sermon that Dr. Keller read at Oxford. The accounts of him in the New Testament speak for themselves. He combines qualities no one has ever seen. Despite his incredible claims, we never see him pompous or standing on his own dignity. Despite being absolutely approachable to the weakest and most broken people, he is completely fearless before the proud and the corrupt. Despite being completely human and becoming weary and lonely and moved to joy and love and anger, we never see him moody. We never see him inconsistent. We never see him being strong when he should be tender, or tender when he should be strong. Most interesting of all, in the accounts of his dealings with people, he is continually surprising us, shocking us, yet never disappointing us. It is difficult to imagine the word Jesus ought to have said, or the deed he ought to have done. Nothing he does falls short. In fact, he is always surprising you and taking your breath away, because he is incomparably better than you could imagine for yourself. Why? These are the surprises of perfection. He is the hope of humanity. He is the personal hope that we long for. Someone who knows you to your depths, but loves you to the skies. He is the master of creation who made himself low just to know you. You can't get much more personal than that. Let's pray. Lord, thank you so much for the hope that you've given us, and it's not a theoretical hope, it's not academic hope, it's real breathing. It's a person, and it's a person who wants to know us, and it's a person who loves us so much that not only just to come down and to be with us, but to actually lay his life down for us. I just pray that we'll probably never understand that fully until we see you, but what limited experience of that we can have on earth, may we have that just for the rest of our lives, Lord. May we continually understand that and just get closer and closer to you and be filled more and